This episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to you by Seton Home Study School. To find out if Seton is right for your family, go to setonhome.org.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Pillar Podcast. It's a podcast that brings you great Catholic conversation each week, and I think you're going to like it. I'm your host and Pillar Editor-in-Chief, J.D. Flynn, and I'm joined by my podcasting partner and Pillar co-founder, Ed Condon. And if this is your first time joining us, welcome, welcome, welcome. All are welcome in this place.
That's Ed? Not true.
Welcome.
It's absolutely not true. That's false. It's false in the hymn. It's false.
Who would not be welcome in this place?
People who listen to the show for the first time and then write us emails saying, I listened to your show for the first time and you're not very good at podcasting. So
we did recently get an email that said, and I quote, you're not very good at podcasting. And you know what? Actually, I welcome that person because this is the difference between you and me. This is a fundamental difference between me and you. We got that you're not very good at podcasting email and you thought, I don't ever want to hear from this person again. And I thought, I've just met the person who I hope will become our biggest fan. I want to do is convince that person that we are very good at podcasting or at least okay at it.
It was not her opinion that we were not very good at podcasting that set me against hearing from her further. It was the then 700 words of friendly advice about how we could do better, most of which consisted of saying, have you ever heard of someone called Matt Frad? You should have him interview you alternately once a month, and that would be far better, and I'd enjoy that
than
far
making
more.
A podcast. I want to say, though, I think many, many people who listen to this show will probably agree. I'm not sure if we're very good at podcasting. I don't listen to any podcasts, so I don't know. And I would not presume to be good at podcasting. And when friends of the show write to us and say, hey, I think the show would be better if you X, Y, or Z, fine. I mean, we're not above anyone.
I'm in favor of constructive criticism, especially from friends and listeners who say, I think the show could do with more of this or less of that, or I like it better when you do this more. That's fine. Writing in to say you're not very good at podcasting, consider not podcasting. That's not helpful.
That was
especially 100? If you take 700 words to say it and I have to read all of it. And especially because I don't pretend that we're great podcasters. I don't pretend that the show makes great listening. But it's our job. Like, I have to do it anyway. This is how I pay the rent. So writing to me and saying, you're not very good at your job, consider not doing your job. That's not helpful. I don't need that.
That was 100% the note that we got. I mean,
So when you say all are welcome, if your purpose here is to tell us we're not very good at our job and we should just quit our jobs, thank you. But we're good. Thanks.
Agreed. Anyway, all are welcome. One way or another, all are welcome. And what we're going to talk about today is the breath of welcome in the Catholic Church. Because what we're going to discuss today, Edward, is a news report which has been making a lot of rounds. Because it's an article that was published this week by the Associated Press about sort of the state of the Catholic Church. It is entitled, A Step Back in Time, America's Catholic Church Sees an Immense Shift Towards the Old Ways. And this news article, which we feel like would be a good springboard for discussion, written by an AP reporter, effectively said, look, after Vatican II, the American church was moving in what it defines as a liberal or progressive direction. And the days of that liberality are over. It says here, let me read to you. Across the U.S., the Catholic Church is undergoing an immense shift. Generations of Catholics who embrace the modernizing tide sparked in the 1960s by Vatican II are increasingly giving way to religious conservatives who believe the church has been twisted by change, with the promise of eternal salvation replaced by guitar masses, parish food pantries, and casual indifference to church doctrine. Effectively, what this article is doing, and it's very long, and it talked to a lot of people, and it kind of went to various places in the Catholic Church, it's sort of juxtaposing what it regards as the liberality of the Catholic Church in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s with what it regards as the conservatism of the Catholic Church today. And it kind of regards that conservatism to include people who we would recognize, I think, as coming from very many tribes, traditionalists, sort of Steubenville type conservatives.
Often warring tribes, I think it would be fair to say.
Well, that could be. The reason we wanted to talk about this article is because it aims to paint a picture of the state of the church in the United States right now. And we thought we might talk a little bit about what it depicts and then what we see from our own sort of perspective in terms of like the state of the board. of the church in the United States right now. Is that what you hope to talk about?
Sure. I have some things that I want to talk about this article. I don't know if they necessarily fit under that loose heading, but that's okay. I'll just shoehorn them in along the way.
That was about the broadest heading that I could give.
Yeah. It's a good heading. It's a good heading. Well done. And well done to AP for publishing this, because I don't like the Associated Press, and I don't respect much of the journalism they do that comes across the, you know, my field of vision, because it touches on the Catholic Church or the faith, or things like that. And this one, I mean, there are criticisms I think that could be made of it, and I'm sure we'll touch on a few of them. But this one didn't offend me. I don't think it insulted the intelligence of the reader. So well done, AP. More of this, please.
Why don't you offer some of your thoughts on this? So you overall like, so if you haven't read this, by the way, again, the title is A Step Back in Time, America's Catholic Church Sees an Immense Shift Toward the Old Ways. If you listen to this show, I think there's probably a pretty good chance that you've seen this float across your desk.
If not, we'll put a link to it in the show notes.
But there's, as I say, there's a link in the show notes. And so, Ed, I have some thoughts, but I'd love to let you start.
Where to begin?
Ed, I have some thoughts, and I'd love to start with them if you would like.
Yes, please, by all means.
Okay, so as I saw it, this story, one of the aspects of the story that I found interesting is it basically aims to depict something that I think we both see in the life of the church right now. There was a Second Vatican Council. Subsequent to the Second Vatican Council, there was a great sort of a great period of experimentation liturgically and catechetically, and a period, I think, of sort of chaos in the life of the church in many ways, where many people who were excited by their perceived sense of the spirit of the council or their perceived sense of the meaning of the council, like, were doing all kinds of things that were unusual. In my newsletter this week, I cited a 1985 instruction from the U.S. bishops about the inadvisability or non-permissibility, impermissibility of clown liturgies at which a person dressed as a clown would be the principal celebrant of the liturgy or lector or something like that. The very fact that such an instruction had to be given by the U.S. bishops in 1985, I think, gives a sense of the kind of experimentation, so to speak, that was going on before that. But the AP notes, like, after Vatican II, there was this great sort of liberalization, and now we are now the conservatives are sort of making their presence felt in the church, or because many people have stopped practicing the faith, conservatives exercise outsized influence on the life of the church. And I think that is getting at something that is true, that there was indeed in the immediate post-conciliar period, there was indeed a lot of ambiguity, and there was indeed a lot of confusion. And there were people, I think, with pernicious motives who took advantage of a period of sort of like great sort of change or upheaval or confusion, or the sort of expectation of engines of change to downplay Catholic doctrine and those kinds of things. And then there were a lot of people who were formed in the immediate post-conciliar period who got, as a result, sort of bad catechesis. And without being kind of malicious at all, just got a vision of the church, her doctrine, her liturgy, her life together, which was anemic, right? Which was basically took up way too much of kind of the world and inserted it into the life of the church. And this comes, I think, both again from people who were sort of like had a pernicious intention in the post-conciliar period, but also from people who I think were just kind of caught up in the spirit of the age, even without any kind of and correlated the Second Vatican Council to what we might call the spirit of the age, which was sort of progress and the dumping of traditional forms of living and the dumping of and a sort of general disdain or disregard for the customs and traditions of one's fathers in favor of a general sense of the world being made new, which is, you know, part and parcel with the sexual revolution and everything else. So like, it wasn't that, you know, and so these people took perhaps a few phrases from Gaudium et Spes about like engaging with the world, and a few phrases with from Sacrosanctum Concilium, the Apostolic Constitution on the liturgy about full active conscious participation in the world. And then they just sort of used that as the base to do in certain ways what they wanted. And then lots of people were sort of sucked up into that and got bad formation. And then those people who got bad formation were responsible for the formation of another sort of generation. And so lots of people who are our age, you know, kind of 40-ish, the religious formation of our youth was notably bad, you know, and sort of that began to be overcome a little bit with people who were with a sort of return to more sanity with the emergence of sort of catechetical programs and new initiatives and things like that. Like I think probably in the late 90s and early 2000s, and has kind of continued to build momentum. And so, you know, AP is saying there's this pendulum shift. I think it's a natural progression after an apostolic, an ecumenical council for there to be a lot of turbidity and a lot of turmoil and a lot of sort of...
Sorry, did you say turbidity?
Yeah, turbidity. Is that a word? Why not? Turbid is a word, right?
Is turbid a word? Is turbid the word you mean?
Oh, turbidity is a measure of the level of particles, such as sediment, plankton, or organic byproducts in a body of water. As the turbidity of water increases, it becomes denser and less clear due to a higher concentration of these light-blocking particles. Yes, turbidity is precisely the word I wish to use. Turbidity is the cloudiness or haziness of a fluid caused by large numbers of individual particles that are generally invisible to the naked eye.
Thank you. I've learned something new.
Yes. I think there was a great deal of turbidity and turmoil and those kinds of things, which have gradually started to shift in another direction. And I've talked before about a friend of mine who was a priest at the time of the Second Vatican, was formed as a seminarian at the time of the Second Vatican Council, and like sort of freely admitted, as many as I think we probably know, a number of priests of that generation who would say, I just got poor formation then because everything was in turmoil. But now, you know, I think we're getting kind of something which is somewhat reactionary to that. And then, you know, I still think we're probably a little bit far away from the moment in which the Second Vatican Council is read as an ecumenical council and integrated into the teaching, you know, into the doctrine of the church concretely and with continuity and things like that. Because right now we're still in the sort of swing of pendulum one way, pendulum another way. And there's still probably a little bit of time before people who are removed from that can read and interpret the council in line with the things which came before it.
Okay. I have an alternative thesis or explanation or read of the situation. Tell me what you think of it.
Okay.
Much of the stuff, and I mean, if I wrote about this a little bit in the newsletter this morning, that if I had what sort of one overarching criticism of the AP thing, and again, it's a grown-up criticism of what I consider to be a grown-up work of going out and talking to a lot of people. So this isn't to dismiss it or say that this is a fatal flaw. This is just the thing that I found myself thinking about, is that the presentation of this sort of older generation, which the AP article largely paints as being sort of frustrated, feeling a sense of their own fading relevance. And, you know, quotes one priest saying, you know, all these kids are just waiting for us to die so they could put everything back. I found that, you know, sort of depressing and, you know, very sad if that's a true representation of how these people feel. And that, you know, the sense I got reading the article, I don't think this is true of an entire generation of Catholics or clergy in the church in this country, but this is how they're represented in the AP piece. I think it's fair to say is that they're very much concerned with the here and now, that is to say their own temporal life. There's no sense of the eternal or, you know, the eschatology, or the life hereafter, that it's, you know, seen very much as, well, the church is an earthly institution, and you know, it's the way in which it moves and looks and smells and sounds is primarily my concern for its identity rather than the church's mandate and, you know, missionary activity or, you know, the salvation of souls doesn't seem to interject much from that sort of generation's point of view as articulated in the AP piece. Again, I don't think that that's a fair representation of that entire generation, which is my criticism of the piece, but that's what the people they talked to said. So taking it on those terms, I would offer an alternative read of the current situation, which is this. A lot of what people associate with the so-called spirit of Vatican II generation that is ugly, naff, dated, the sort of Dan Shooty music, felt banners, you know, guitar masses, that sort of thing, all of which, you know, the AP piece describes, all of that coming into the church when it did has almost nothing to do with the Second Vatican Council in terms of it being an expression of the council. It was merely the first thing that came in when the council sort of opened up a new avenue for the church to be enculturated and shaped in different parts of the world. And so it just immediately began to reflect the wider world and culture. Because to a certain degree that was, you know, part of the intention was that the church, including in the liturgy stuff, wouldn't be completely closed off, wouldn't be so sui generis that it, you know, the modern man couldn't see his own place in it. And what you got was what the rest of the world and culture looked like in the 1970s, which is polyester, nasty aesthetics, bad music. You know, no one looks at the 1970s and goes, man, that we had great architecture and fabulous music. You know, it's the era of bell bottoms, disco, and brutalist architecture. And what we commonly ascribe to being the sort of first flush of enthusiasm for quote unquote the spirit of the council is really just 70s culture coming into the church and suddenly having room to manifest itself because of that. And that rather than seeing a pendulum swing, what we're seeing now is the real harvest emerging of what the council sowed authentically, which is to say, you know, the council made a great deal of changes, is debatably the right or wrong word, but placed a great emphasis on the rediscovery of the role of the diocesan bishop, the importance and character of the particular church, the role of the laity, the universal dignity and mission of all of the Christian faithful. The sort of radical equality of the people of God, and all of the things that we tend to think of as "quote unquote" backlashes against the spirit of Vatican II. I mean, in a sense, maybe people even involved in them think of it that way because what they see themselves as changing or reacting to is this sort of NAF 70 stuff. But actually, what it is this is what the council originally intended, which is, you know, you think about the things that we associate with the sort of pendulum swing in the other direction. The AP article highlights, and we've talked about on the show many, many times, the sort of Denver World Youth Day as a pivotal moment. New ecclesiastical movements, whether they be the Focolare, Communion Liberation, the Neo Catechumenal Way, stuff like that. Local catechesis, a rediscovery of, you know, parishes asking for a different style of liturgy that is, you know, whether it's more traditional or modern or whatever you want to, but is more reverent, is more, you know, reflecting the full active conscious participation of the lay faithful, that this is all what the council originally intended. It's just, it's taken several decades for the seeds to go into the ground and bear fruit and come up again. And I don't think what we're seeing so much is necessarily a pendulum swing of sort of liberal to conservative and, you know, it snaps back and forth. But what we're seeing is the mature flowering of the original seed of the council. We just often confuse the sort of contemporary bad aesthetics of the decade when the council was concluded with something that was itself a fruit of the council.
Right.
And that's what made me particularly sad reading these quotes from all of these priests in their 70s and 80s in this AP article, who were all sort of saying, you know, well, the church is, as I've always understood it, is basically disappearing and these kids are trying to, you know, burn it all down. And what made me sad about that was it seemed to prioritize the sort of 70s aesthetics, the sort of cultural shtick of disco, ecclesiastically speaking, and saying, no, this is the nature of the church. This is the church we were trying to build, rather than say, well, no, the church isn't about your favorite hymn. The church isn't about what style of vestments you like. The church isn't about, you know, pick your flavor, whether you like, you know, shine Jesus shine, or whether you like chanting the Tantum Ergo. You know, these are expressions of what's supposed to be the core of the faith, which is true liturgy, evangelization, love of God, love of neighbor, moving towards the eternal. And that's what I didn't read in the article and made me sad. And if what we are seeing now is, and I think we are to a large extent, a rediscovery generationally of the sense of the sacred and the reality of the eternal over what was a broader cultural trend and phenomena of the late 20th century, sort of 70s, 80s, 90s, of a sort of nihilistic temporal relativism, then I think we're right on schedule. And it's not a pendulum swing. This is just the slow arc of history bending where it's supposed to go.
Yeah, I think you make a lot of interesting points. And one of the things that is well met in what you've said, and I think perhaps pretty seriously misunderstood in the story, is that if what you're seeing is basically a stepping back from the horizontality of the spirit of the age and back into sort of a priority on the spiritual, the transcendent, and the last things, that will actually have various expressions, various aesthetic expressions, and And it will be okay. Like, it seems to me that if your focus is on the universal call to holiness, and what you read in the Second Vatican Council is the universal call to holiness, and the church's communion, and the church's sacrament of salvation towards sanctity, you will recognize like that various kind of expressions, various cultural expressions, even in the American context, might all be oriented towards serving that, such that folks who are traditionally inclined liturgically can sort of fit into your worldview at the same time that folks who are inclined towards shine, Jesus shine, as you say, can fit into your worldview, because liturgy is well celebrated and celebrated towards the worship of God. Have more in common with each other, regardless of the accidents of aesthetics, than liturgy sort of celebrated towards a sort of horizontality or sort of communality, or liturgy celebrated sort of merely as obligation with a certain kind of banality or something like that. Like, does that make sense? Like,
it does. And I guess as a partial proof of my thesis, I'd put it to you this way: the kind of diversity that you are talking about, and which you've said to me and other people I know. You thought one of the sort of Achilles heels of the AP piece was that it only understood things through the prism of old liberal and young conservative, and didn't understand that within the, you know, the sort of bucket of young, we're talking about, you know, three decades worth of Catholics at this point. There was a diversity of priority and preference and emphasis across almost every part of ecclesiastical life. And that just because next to, you know, the St. Louis Jesuits, those people all look quote unquote conservative, then you just put them in one big bucket and say right wing. And I think you're right that is a mistake. But what I would ask you to see is like, okay, just look at that, unpack that diversity, unpack where the energy is coming from across that whole range. It's ground up. It's, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's people. It's an entire generation or two at this point calling for things, making known to their pastors their needs and requirements in line with the, you know, writing of the code, all these things in ways and in tones and with results that would have been unthinkable prior to the Second Vatican Council.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, what we're seeing now is not a snapback against Vatican II. What we're seeing now is like all of this stuff that we're talking about, and people are labeling young and conservative and quote unquote anti-Vatican II, and, you know, the empire
is indeed an expression of the Second Vatican.
It's only possible because of the Second Vatican Council. It's unthinkable. Like, you wouldn't get mass movements of lay people in the parishes saying, "Father, we want mass celebrated like this," before Vatican II. The priest would be like, "I'm sorry, what?"
I had a conversation. It was very interesting. Recently, with a young, surprisingly young priest who is very dynamic. Like,
when you say surprisingly young priest, you mean like 16? That would be very surprising.
You're right. I had a conversation recently with a priest whom I respect a great deal and like very much, who is quite young, and because of the disposition he reflected in his conversation, I was surprised that the disposition he reflected in his conversation was coming from a priest as young as he. But we were at a party, and you know, because we were at a party, and I had probably had my fill of party for the, as you know, I'm somewhat introverted. And so I found sort of a quiet, you think that I'm not introverted because I'm outgoing, but I can only do that for so long. And then I needed a place to retreat.
I've never seen J.D. Flynn in retreat, and we've spent a lot of time together. We've spent weeks of our lives on the road together.
Yeah, no,
we've
been
actually in many a crowded room as a pair. I've never seen you step back.
Yeah, but then what happens after the crowded room? What happens is you're like, well, let's go get a drink and keep talking to each other. And I'm like, actually, I'm going to go to my room and work or something like that. When what I really mean is I need to go recharge because I've been spending a lot of time around people.
Oh, I've been misreading you. I thought you were just saying, I thought you were just trying to stop me having fun and like saying, yeah, you want to keep going drinking, but really we should get back to work
because
we're not
going to
get our full 14 hours in today.
No, I don't care if you have fun. I often, when you're like, if we have a lengthy evening with someone and then you're like, now we should go da da da, and I'm like, actually, I'm going to go to my room and work. What I usually mean is, man, that exhausted me. And I
That's
need a break
surprising.
From
I'm the exact opposite.
I know you are. You're a very extroverted person. You just don't know.
No, I'm not an extroverted person. There's nothing I hate and fear more than a crowded room of strangers. But
that's different. You're a shy extrovert.
What I want and require to recover from the trauma of dealing with other people whom I don't know in an uncomfortable or unfamiliar setting is I then need the quiet comfort of a one-on-one conversation with someone who I actually do know.
Exactly. You want after a long evening or a lengthy lunch or a party, you want to like unpack it with me for a while. You want like you're recharged by like then you and I or you and me and another friend or you and Mrs. Khan, whatever, have a more intimate or personal conversation.
Whereas chat.
Yeah. Whereas what I need after something like that is just like, I got to get away from people now and close my eyes.
That's wow. Okay. I'm learning so much today.
Anyway, that makes you an extrovert, by the way.
No, I don't think it does, but okay.
It does. It's a very, okay. So, so I retreated to another room and it was a quiet room. And then a priest who I like very much came and sat down and I was like, oh yeah, cool. And so, and then he was like, hey, I have a question. And I was hoping it would be, he wanted to talk. And so, we got to talking about church politics for a while, 'cause that's what people like to talk about with me. And then he wanted to know, he said to me, why do you think so many young people are so invested in the liturgy? And I said like, well, what do you mean? And he said like, why do you think all these young people have all these strong opinions about like, you know, Latin and all of this stuff? And like, why is this so important to them? And so I sort of said like, well, you know, I think things that I've said on the show before, like I think that young people are looking for something different and something sacred and something transcendent and something beyond kind of the banality of their ordinary experience and something which has the sense of permanence and continuity that in a death of the reassurance of tradition and familial and cultural continuity, people are looking for something which gives them the idea of continuity. Plus people want to worship God well and these kind, and that's a deep human intuition to want to worship God well and things like that. And he sort of listened and then he said, but why is that like a layperson? Why would lay people be interested in that? Shouldn't they be interested in like going out into the world and things like that? And it was a surprisingly preconciliar opinion to me for a priest in his early 30s. And it didn't align in my observation with many of the things that is even sort of this guy's own ministry. He works with people who work in the church and things like that. But it seems
to me
obvious.
Can I just make as a footnote here to that story, which I think you're right, is interesting. Trads get all the oxygen when it comes to quote-unquote young people. And by young people, I think we can safely mean anyone under 50 at this point. Quote-unquote young people being really invested in liturgy. Like everyone I know of our age or the generation under us is, I think, deeply interested in and invested in the liturgy. But I'd say only about a third of them skew trad.
Well, like, lots of them skew.
I want ad orientem. I want more Latin.
I think more than a third of them skew. If you make the category that big, if you mean trad plus reverent Novus Ordo, I think that's a pretty
reverent. Hang on.
Am I making your question? I most certainly.
This is you are making my point for me. You're reinforcing my original point, which is if you want reverent liturgy, what you mean is you want as close to the preconciliar liturgy as possible. You want trad liturgy, and
no,
that's
I don't think you want as close.
True.
To what is your experience of the other two thirds?
That they're equally invested in reverent liturgy, right liturgy, liturgy that has the worship of God and the experience of the sacramental and sacred at the center of it, rather than, you know. Where's that parish that you always see the videos flooding up about, you know, where father's blessing the assembly with a guitar?
Oh, yeah, all that.
The
stuff.
Deacon's up there making giant bubbles on the sanctuary.
The parish is somewhere in the Archdiocese of Chicago, I think, but I can't. I probably can't remember.
That's not the true split. Is like you're either in favor of that or you like things that, you know, more closely resemble the preconciliar liturgy. I don't think that's true, but you can have people who are like, yeah, I'm perfectly comfortable with and used to versus populum, and I see it celebrated with great dignity and reverence all of the time, and it doesn't inhibit my ability to appreciate
I'm perfectly comfortable and used to versus populum too, and it's not a hill I would die on. But if you ask me what I think is better, I honestly think that ad orientem is better. It doesn't mean I think that it's right for every parish to just be introduced in a willy nilly way. Da da da. But like at my own when I think about my own funeral liturgy, for example, which is probably the only liturgy left over which I have any reasonable hope of control, I certainly
only if you die second.
I know Kate has made that point actually.
You can write whatever you want, but your spouse is going to decide what goes in the liturgy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's if you die second, you have a great deal of control over a funeral liturgy. If you die first, you can't possibly hope for that. At any rate, I don't see the movement that I tend to see among young people who are invested in liturgy is more towards what I would say are traditional things, whether that means sort of full trad or a sort of reform of the Reform Novus Ordo, which means more Latin.
Maybe you know. I just have a wider social circle than you.
Well, I think you have
a greater diversity of people.
I think what you have.
But that's because I'm an extrovert.
I think what you have, we'll talk about what you have when we're back from this commercial. I need a break from people. Ed, this week's episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to us by the Seton Home Study School. Seton Home Study School is an accredited school, which you can find out a lot about at setonhome.org. And Seton Home Study School provides for your family textbooks, resources, consultation, curriculum, all the things that you need to make homeschooling your children a possibility for you with all the benefits, backing up, and support of a fully accredited school. Homeschooling is not for every family, but that doesn't mean it's not for some families. In fact, I think it is for some families. And one of the real things that I think is most rich about homeschool, one of the things that I appreciated in the years when my family homeschooled, was that homeschooling allows every child to move at their pace and to sort of be challenged to the fullness of their own capacity. Scaffolding and accommodating different learning styles, different learning paces, different abilities and gifts in the classroom is tough, right? Because the teacher, no matter how sort of well-informed they are about those things, has a certain number of students, has the obligation to teach all of those students. And so classrooms tend towards the mean, right? Sort of the mean student, which means that students who are moving more quickly through material than that, or students who are in need of more help, more instruction, more personal engagement in a one-on-one way, can sometimes be lost, right, in this sort of shuffle of things. But one of the advantages of homeschooling that we found certainly in our family is that homeschooling allows the kind of one-on-one instruction in which is directly tied to the capacity and the pace and the learning style of the individual child. And that can result in really good study habits. That can result in, I think, intellectual humility. I think that can result in the kind of disposition towards learning that one would wish for a child to have for the whole of life.
Yeah. And I mean, I can remember well enough my own experiences in school that, you know, you can be absolutely drowning in one subject and bored out of your mind in another because everyone has different aptitudes. Everyone has a different skill set. Everyone has things to which they take naturally and things that they necessarily struggle with. And one of the great benefits, as you say, that I can see in homeschooling and certainly using the curricula and textbooks of stuff like Seton is that, you know, if the kid is a voracious reader, you can go at that pace. You can bring them along through the course material, you know, as far through it as they and as fast as they want to go. And if they need more help, like I certainly did in math, then you can go as slow as you need, that you can tailor the curriculum to the child. And it stops either the child being sort of, you know, burning out with frustration and sort of self-recrimination and not being able to keep pace. And at the same time, not growing bored. And as you say, intellectually incurious, because you feel like, you know, you're just stuck in a holding pattern with something that you know, you've long moved past.
The other thing about homeschooling and flexibility is that it's not only about flexibility to tailor the curriculum to the particular child and the pace to the particular child, but homeschooling also allows, I think, for a family to do school at the pace that's right for their family, to adapt when there's something going on in the family, when there's need in the family, if you want to take a trip, if you are just kind of going through a difficult time, to kind of slow things down, or to think if the sort of traditional school calendar is not the right sort of pace for your family, or better to take to do school intensely for a couple of weeks and then take breaks, or better to do school only in the mornings and then do outings in the afternoon. There's so much sort of flexibility for the needs of a particular family. And Seton Home Study School program provides resources that allow parents to make the decisions about school as it's right for their family and as it's right for their particular children. You can find out a lot about that at setonhome.org. And you can also call Seton and talk with some of the teachers and educators on their staff about what that might look like for your family. Because the whole idea is to think about education in the context of your family, in the particularities of your family, and the particularities of your own children.
That's setonhome.org.
We're back, Ed, and what we're talking about today is this Associated Press sort of sketch of the church, and we have gone down a liturgical We have gone down something of a liturgical rabbit hole, and that was fine, and it was very interesting. But I want to talk about another kind of element of this that I, of this story that I noticed that I think fits into a common trope, a common sort of mistaken trope about the life of the church in the United States, which is that as hard as I think it tries, I think the author really did try here. But as hard as the author tries, I think that the AP reporter here had a very difficult time separating the lines of demarcation within Catholicism from the lines of political allegiance, the sort of American lines of political allegiance. Like at the end of the day, I think the author was really unable to escape his idea that there are left-wing Catholics and right-wing Catholics in the same way that there are left-wing and right-wing Americans. And there are, I mean, to be clear, there are sort of, I think we could say, broadly speaking, sort of progressive Catholics in a certain sense whose theology is progressive. And then there are Catholics who are sort of rightward leaning. But I don't think those terms mean at all. I mean, I just think the lines of demarcation in Catholicism are so very different from that. And it is a shallow Catholicism, not an uncommon Catholicism, but it is a shallow Catholicism which is subordinated entirely to one sort of political to one sort of political leanings.
Yeah, I think that's right. I found it also interesting, and I don't know if you picked up on this. It talks a lot about how there's a sort of demographic discrepancy in terms of influence that quote unquote young and conservative people sort of swinging a bigger stick than they ought in the church because they're institutionally present effectively. Mm-hmm. By that, I mean, they're actively practicing the faith, going to mass.
That's right, exactly. And it was like, that was one of the funniest things. It's like, people who practice the faith are exercising an undue influence on the shape, the trajectory of the church. It's like, oh.
Right. And it's sort of, and I found that interesting because the author has this sort of wider political vision. I mean, I say political. The thing is, it's sacramentally, it's true, but not in the way that I think he was thinking about it, which is he seemed to have this idea of a sort of, you know, the wider Catholic franchise,
right?
Of, you know, those who don't go to mass, who don't actually believe what the church teaches, but they're still Catholics. And, you know, those people aren't getting fair representation in their parishes, even though they don't go to them, and, you know, all this sort of stuff. And their liturgical preferences, despite the fact that they don't, you know, care about liturgy or worship God.
Or produce priests or something like that.
Or produce priests or anything like that. And so I found that very funny because it's this sort of notion of sort of portraying Catholics who practice the faith, who believe what the church teaches, as sort of hyper-politically engaged. As you know, and you know, your sort of average boomer liberal, as the article conceives it, is, you know, more of a quiet stay-at-home type. Like, you know, I show up on polling day, but, you know, I don't have to, you know, politics is in the center of my life. And I found that very, very funny because, you know, the faith should be the center of everyone's life. That's the purpose of Catholicism. If that's not what you think, then you've missed something in the faith. But of course, it's also true to say that all baptized Catholics are Catholics, properly speaking. They are members of the church, properly speaking.
Yes.
And if they are institutionally disaffiliated, as generationally that particular tends to be, they are no less Catholic for it, but you know, what's funny to me is he seemed to be drawing out the contours of a very wide sort of existential periphery of the church mm-hmm. in the United States, which needs to be re-evangelized. Not from the sense of, you know, we need to make people who don't like good music. And, you know, we need to convince people that, you know, bad liturgy is bad and All Our Welcome is a terrible hymn. You know, not about that, but about saying, you know, these people seem to lack a sense of the primacy of the salvific mission of the church and the significance of their baptism as the means of their salvation in their mm-hmm. lives, particularly as they approach, and as some of the people quoted in the article were, as they approach their own death, that, you know, that seems to be a sort of pastoral emergency that, you know, I think very well sketched out, but isn't actually identified for what
as
it
such.
Is.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's right. And so, yeah, but that actually becomes a mandate for those who practice the faith. Like one of the things that I think is a challenge for people who practice the faith today and young people who have their sort of traditionalist liturgical identities and all of that is there can be a temptation to sort of, and it drives me nuts. There can be a temptation to sort of like simply dismiss the generation of Catholics who was poorly formed or who did the poor formation in the conciliar and post-conciliar period with the sort of mockery of like Susan from the Bears Council kind of stuff or, oh, boomer priest. Like, to the extent that it is true that young Catholics are sort of waiting around for Father Boomer to die, as Father Boomer said in the story, that's a tragedy and a failure, right? Like that, means that that means that young Catholics have sort of
woefully
misunderstood. To what extent is it true? Well, I will say I have heard and you have heard that kind of language. It's not like I think the AP is making that up entirely. I've certainly heard, you know, people joke about like, oh, we just need to get over felt ban on liturgies. We just need to wait for the biological solution. Like that, that does exist. Now, I think that it would be facile to sort of see that as the sole kind of current in the church's life with regard to generational divides. But it does exist, and I think it needs to be corrected where it does exist. But I also know many young priests who are themselves like theologically orthodox and who desire sort of a reform of the liturgical reform and things like that, who have a great care for and a great reverence for older priests with whom they probably vehemently disagree about some, you know, about like pastoral ministry and the theology, the sort of pastoral theology and the relationship of pastoral theology to moral theology and the church's magisterial teaching and things like that, who nevertheless have a great sort of love and affection for their older forebears and who will be called upon to care for them in their dotage.
Well, that, and also they have in many cases received a lot from them. I mean, you can say what you want about, you know, generations of poor formation in seminaries and things. But you know, the generation that get derided as sort of, you know, Father Boomer or whatever, those are the guys who actually, the fact that they're still in the priesthood is itself really saying something, that that's the generation that had, you know, huge numbers of priests leave, seek laicization voluntarily. That, you know, this is the generation of Father Parochial Vicar and Sister Mary Pantsuit, you know, decide to leave the Holy Orders to get married and they're going to go become social workers. And that, like, that sort of stereotype exists for a reason. Like, demographically, a lot of priests of that generation abandoned the ministry, abandoned the church. And these are the guys who didn't. These are the guys who kept to their priesthood, who kept to their ministry and have and are keeping to it still. And, you know, they have a wealth of practical lived experience and wisdom that they give to young guys who, like every generation of priests, have moments of crisis in their vocation, have moments of crisis in their priesthood, and need the lived examples of guys who can say, no, I've been there. I understand. You know, this is a normal part of the human condition and trying to live, you know, the sacrament of holy orders, trying to live the condition of the clerical state. Like, you know,
and that's why there's a way through this. You see that kind of derisive generational talk, I think, mostly in – it is exacerbated by the atomizing and sensationalizing effects of sort of online culture, right? So like if you have lived experience with that generation of Catholics and you engage with them, or your parents are kind of boomery Catholics or something like that, you can hold like, oh no, there was a problem here and I have a great like love and sentimental affection for these folks, or I can, you know, some yes, some no, whatever, in an ordinary way. But
well, like, and respect. I mean, the same is true for you. Like, the best professors we had were priests of that generation.
Oh, were the archetypes of that, architects of that generation, maybe.
Yeah, well, in many respects, we're caricatures of and them, you know, almost, like, in dress and presentation.
Know, like, I had this great sort of crisis. Like, I started canon law school when I was 22 or 23. I just finished a master's at Steubenville, and I did my undergraduate at Steubenville. And so my whole positive experience of the church was Steubenville, effectively. And then I went to CUA, and my first class was with a priest in a tie, and I had this little existential crisis, like, what is this? This is what I was warned about. Is he a believer? Da, da, da. And then this guy turned out to be, yes, he had the affectations of his generation, which I think are silly. And if I saw him today, I'd tell him, I think those affectations are silly. And he had the affectations of his generation. But then, like, I learned, oh, wow, and he is also a disciple of Jesus Christ who loves the Lord and who loves me and who wants to exercise good pastoral care for me and loves Christ and his church and these kinds of things.
And has carved out several private pastoral ministries for himself in addition to his teaching duties and is, you know, living the priesthood
right,
in a very
real
way.
That's exactly right. But these kinds of tendencies, we need to sort of examine ourselves to ask, do these kinds of sensationalizing, absolutist, divisive tendencies of island culture, to what extent do they need to be sort of rebuked where they exist in the church? And I think they exist. You know, people always say the church of the parish is not the church of the internet. And I think increasingly it is, because
kind of is.
Yeah, because so many practicing Catholics, because there are fewer and fewer practicing Catholics, like the idea like, oh, this stuff that you guys are talking about is not what people in the pews talk about. Well, I don't know that, because I go to a lot of places with people who are ordinary practitioners of the faith who want to ask me about church stuff like this. You know what I mean? So,
well, and I get a lot of text messages from priests that I know socially, not through work, that say, what is, and, you know, give some website, you know, some crazy fringe website.
Because it's popping up as an issue at my parish or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm getting, you know, people keep asking me, who is, you know, who is Taylor Marshall? You know, it's like, that's, yeah, I'm sorry.
The internet today fringe is asking you, who is Taylor Marshall? He's
happened recently? Real example. I mean, defined recently. Was last 6 months, year. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh, he's a good priest. He doesn't hang out online and, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So the AP story got some things right, was unnuanced in some things, conflated a lot of things. Like, we didn't really talk about this, but conflated sort of the I think that one thing that has happened in the past 10 years is that a sort of broad kind of coalition of Catholics who you might call JP2 Catholics have been fractured by a couple of factors. One, Traditionis Custodes prompted a lot of pushback and people to sort of more concretely identify in the traditionalist way. And there is, I think, to some extent, a broadening. There's a lot of sympathy for traditionalist Catholics, but then there's also a broadening of like even within traditionalists, liturgically inclined traditionalists, between people who are like the extraordinary form, or people who are sympathetic to people who like the extraordinary form, and then the sort of Vigano universe of the church, right? Like, there's this sort of emerging kind of hard traditionalist kind of Vigano anti-institutional element of the church, which can be.
I have a question. Yeah. And you identify as a hard traditionalist wing of the church, and you raise Vigano. Vigano was a nut job and a conspiracy theorist before he became a sort of quote unquote liturgical.
No, I don't know about that, actually.
I think so. I mean, I think you follow his direction of travel from the initial sort of Vigano report, mm-hmm. in the immediate aftermath of the McCarrick scandal, which, you know, was one thing. And then there was a succession of sort of descent into incoherence and conspiracy theories and everything else. I think he went down the conspiracy theory rabbit hole and got very Donald Trumpy and sort of, you know, politics and political figures are the
messianic. Oh, projecting both Trump, yeah, and Putin in messianic language with regularity.
Well, he was all in on Trump until Trump, I forget what he did, but at that point he said, okay, it's not Trump, it's Putin. Putin is actually the one that, you know, God has ordained to save us from modernism or whatever. But that
I think that shift was part and parcel with the other.
I perceived Vigano as a fringe conspiracy theorist figure before I perceived him becoming a sort of rad trad, liturgically speaking. And it was my sense that he bought into one having already gone down the other rather than the other way around. But maybe I'm wrong. That was just my sense of it.
Anywho, there's that. But then there's also like politics has fractured, has been a fractionalizing force, especially politics in the social media era. Like, that has, I think, created more and more kinds of divisions among Catholics, very honestly, like who kind of fits into your ecclesial tribe and your political tribe, and how do people respond to Pope Francis? And a greater number of people who I talk with are like rabidly, you know, what they want to talk about every time I talk to them is like Pope Francis, worst Pope or worst Pope ever. And that has come to define so much of their Catholicism. So I do think that the last 10 years, the sort of broad, in the same way that the last 10 years have seen the fracturing of what was the sort of Bush era neoconservative coalition into lots of tiny little segments and slivers, which fall on the sort of political and cultural landscape in different ways, like pickup sticks dropped and sort of scattered. I do think that has happened to some extent in the church too, and you have much more of a kind of slivering in the manner of dropping a lot of pickup sticks. And on the other hand, many more people are now sort of sympathetic towards the extraordinary form types than probably were before Traditionis Custodes and stuff like that. So it just seems to me that there is division in the church over the last 10 years, and that division has sort of fractured what was once a sort of broad swath of Catholics.
Thesis.
Yeah. And that the AP story misunderstood that and used language that was weird, like to call focus traditionalist or just things like that, was just demonstrated that they didn't understand a lot of these different groups and how they relate to each other.
Thesis. In the same way that polyester bell bottoms and disco is, you know, the sort of cultural analog to felt banners and bad liturgy in the 70s and the immediate years after the council, but were not themselves products of the council, but merely reflections within the church of the culture of the times. Atomization and sort of trends towards the internet fringe are the same phenomena for this generation.
I totally agree. Yeah, totally agree. Yep. And that is picked up in the life of the church. And I don't think just on the internet.
But so in the same way that people have the stereotype of the true church of the Vatican II era is identified by what are effectively the worst of external cultural contemporary cultural markers coming into the life of the church for the 70s, the same thing is true now, that people are identifying the worst sort of wider social trends that can also be seen in the body of the church as, oh, well, this is the church of the moment. When in fact, the real authentic life of the church is something that is underneath, that is all the things we talked about earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't like the demarcation between the real authentic church and its expression, but I know what you're getting at.
No, I don't mean that there are two churches. I just mean that one is commenting on the church, one's commenting on external fashion rather than internal substance.
Yeah, I would just say that the church only exists in its lived reality, and these are the challenges of being the church right now.
Sure, but the parts of the church that are most reflective of contemporary society are also the parts that have least to do with the church's true and essential nature, which is timeless.
Yeah, I concur. Have you written a game for me?
I have not.
Oh, I thought you were going to do that.
Sorry, I wanted to, but I got caught up in stuff.
Okay, well.
How's baseball going?
Baseball's going great. I'm in an overlap of baseball right now. Max's team is in the playoffs. Max has a game, the first playoff game. Well, we got a bye for the first round because we finished the regular season 8-0.
I'm sorry, you went undefeated?
Yeah, totally. We dominated.
Did you win the league?
Well.
Or the division?
We finished. I don't know. I don't have a map of the league in my mind or like
well,
a
how
bracket.
How many teams are in the league?
I don't know. We just go to the games, and then coach said that we finished in first place, which seemed obvious to me because we finished 8-0.
So you did win. If you finished in first place, you won.
But you don't get anything from that. Like you don't get any. Like all that means is we got to buy for the first round.
That's.
I don't think we get a banner.
If you finish first place in the league, you win the pennant.
We won the pennant. Sure. Yes, we won the pennant. And
now
you
get a ring for that sucker.
And now the playoffs have begun. I think you don't get a ring until you win the championship in this.
Well, you get a. Sometimes you'll get the teams will do rings for. Winning a pennant.
I agree, but I'll talk with coach about whether we want to buy the kids rings.
I think you need to at least get pennants. You should get like, and you know, staying topical, a felt pennant. You know, the ones like when you were a kid, did you have those felt triangle pennants hanging in your room? I had dozens of them.
Yeah.
You should get those made. I bet you there's an internet company that do custom orders of those.
I bet there is.
For cheap.
I bet the guy who prints our uniforms can do them. I'll talk to coach about whether the guy who prints our uniforms can do them.
You win the pennant, you need a pennant. I
tend to agree. Okay, so we got a bye for the first round of the playoffs. The second round of the playoffs is, you know, our game for round two of the playoffs is tonight, but Max used to miss it because I have an auction. And
You've become such an accomplished auctioneer that I don't even know when you're doing them anymore. It used to be a big deal. you used to tell me weeks in advance, like, I got another auction. I got booked.
I have an auction tonight, and it's a big one. So Max has to miss baseball because I go with Max to baseball and that sort of thing. He needs it. But I suspect, I would hope that we're going to win tonight's game. And so I think we're playing, if I recall correctly, I believe we're playing St. Vincent de Paul, I think, which is a pretty good team. But I think we'll, given that we went 8-0, I just expect that we'll win. Cause I think we were only, I think we spent in the whole of the season, by my count, I think we spent 4 innings playing from behind, which is pretty good. Right. So
yeah.
I think we'll do okay. So then,
well, how many innings are you playing in these games?
The games are called at 2 hours. And generally speaking, we play 5 to 6 innings in 2 hours.
Okay. But it's not Because a lot of leagues, you'll do like 6 innings or 2 hours, whichever happens first. But you're saying it's just 2 hours is game time, and however many innings you get through, like do you finish the inning you're in when you hit the 2 hour mark?
Yes, because the ump has called time and then we finish the inning that we're in, or the half inning that we're in at the very least.
Half inning. I mean, unless it's a walk off, I suppose. If the home team is winning, you can call it the half inning, I suppose. But I mean, it seems pretty grim if you're halfway through an inning, the visitors are up, and you're just sorry you don't get your last at bat, home team.
Yeah, I don't think they would do that. I don't have the rule book for the league in front of me, but a guy on our team had a walk-off grand slam in the last game of the season. It was awesome.
Hot dog.
It was so cool.
Check his bat. He might have had a hot
bat. No, he's on our team.
Yeah, but I mean, it's good for you to know. I mean, you want to know what's going on in your own locker room.
If
he's got a hot bat, just make sure you tape it up so the other coach can't see the markings on it and Google it or anything.
He hit it out of the park.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was super cool. And he had hit an in-the-parker. He had hit an in-the-parker earlier in the game. Like, he hit it, and the fielding was such that he
– It's an infield home run.
Yeah, an on-field home run. Yeah. So it's cool. So I'm in double baseball right now, though, because Max is still in the playoffs, but Davey's sort of coach pitch first and second grade league starts soon, and I'm an assistant coach for that team. But Davey has been wanting to do a lot of batting practice. So Davey and I go down to the high school field probably 3-4 days a week, and I pitch to him, and he hits the ball. I mean, I'm surprised he hits the ball out of the infield. One problem with coach pitch is that when you're trying to lob it, like, I think if I stood on the pitcher's mound, I could throw strikes all day, but I'm standing kind of close trying to lob it, and my accuracy with that is not that great. So I've been...
Coach pitch strikes me as, I would never want to do that. I never did coach pitch when I was a kid. You went from... When I was a kid, you went from T-ball to straight to player pitch. But I feel like you're left with a choice, which is either you're just serving up beach balls to the kids, which I would find very, very hard
to
do.
It's
well, you want to strike them out. I mean,
no, they're on your team. You're pitching to your own team.
Oh, you pitch. Oh, so it's
Yes.
Nah, I'd want to challenge them. It's a learning experience. You want to make sure they can hit the curve. You know, you want to make sure they can read the off speed, all of that. And but more than that, I would be terrified of beaning one of the kids.
Well, I'll tell you what I have been terrified of ever since it happened to me is Davey hit a comebacker that walloped me in the forehead. Like, my son, who is six, hit a line drive that walloped me in the forehead, and I fell down. And since then, I have been flinching from the mound every time the kid hits a line drive. He's six.
Pitcher's first fielder, man. You gotta be ready.
I know.
Eyes on the ball.
But I wasn't ready, and now I
question.
Now I'm sure.
What is the form on player on coach pitch, little league? If you're pitching to your own players when they're at bat, but the other team is in the field, is it expected that you'll field like a gentleman and try and get the out on your own kids? Or is it expected that you will just, you know, if the ball comes back at you, you'll drop to the ground and let it go any which way?
You are supposed to play classy. Now, there's no stealing.
Will you cover first?
I think it would be, I mean, you should, right? But I tend to think, I have yet to see the games, right?
When you're covering first.
I have yet to see the games, but I think it would be, what the worst version of coach pitch would be dads who aim to live out their own infielder dreams of glory.
At the expense of their own children.
At the expense of their own children, right? By bounding over to cover first, or by like dashing in on a drop third strike to cover home plate and then, you know, make the four, you know, get the out at home plate or something like that. Like, that would... I think that coach pitch requires a certain level of class and modesty.
But you got to model success for the kids. Like, if they see coach not hustling to cover first, why are they going to ever do it?
When are you – like, you could start coaching Little League now. You know, you don't have to wait for – like, it's perfectly fine for just some dude in the neighborhood to contact the local Little League and say, I'd like to coach.
Yeah, and then I can end up on a watch list and with a deputy sheriff dogging my every step. Sure, I'm going to do that.
I'll tell you a role that I have really enjoyed in middle school baseball is that I'm bringer of the sunflower seeds and other snacks.
Yes, you have. That seems like an important role. I have a question. You mentioned on the Twitters the other day you wished your parish had a softball team.
Yeah, don't you?
Yeah, I wished it out loud. Turns out mine does.
Oh, you should join.
I think I'm gonna.
You should. Question I mark, just have been doing Iron so Burgundy? Much baseball lately that all, like, when I was at middle school baseball practice yesterday and we were practicing for the playoffs and, you know, like, so we were rotating from the infield to the plate, you know, right. And then me and a couple of the other dads were in the outfield to shag fly balls if any went and stuff like that. And Max was with me and stuff. But I just wanted to, you know, hit some balls.
I kind of want to do this. I mean, I have a softball bat. I have my glove. You know, I'm not unprepared, but I wonder if culturally I'm unprepared. Because there must be, I would assume, in the local Catholic Dads League for softball, a set of pretty well understood social norms and unspoken rules of conduct that I worry I would not know and I would transgress on frequently. Because yes, my entire understanding of male adult softball comes from stories from my father from Chicago softball in the 80s and, you know, meeting his old teammates and stuff like that. And I don't think that culture will have much in common with the local Catholic dads where I live.
Local Catholic dad softball, I would guess, is getting out there, stretching out the old hamstrings, possibly having a 12-pack in the dugout.
This was my first question. Is it acceptable to drink in the dugout?
Why else are you there? I mean,
people can be sometimes clean living. I don't know. So that was my first question: is it socially acceptable to drink in the dugout? And you're saying that your gut instinct is yes. So even if it's not the case here, I won't be so wildly culturally off base that, you know, people are going to look at me like I'm a lunatic.
Honestly, I think you'd be the hero of the league if you went up to bat with a cigarette in your mouth.
That was, I think, you anticipate question two, smoking in the outfield. I hadn't considered going up to bat smoking.
I think every dad in the league would think you were the coolest dude, whether they were interested in ecclesiastical politics or not, if you went up to the bat with a cigarette in your mouth.
I'm going to do it. I'm doing it.
Yeah. I'm hoping that someone will tell me that my parish has a team or that some nearby parish has a team or something like that. If you
sidebar quick to business show, meeting. If I do join this team,
I saw you make a commitment of thousands of dollars, thousands of my dollars.
Thousands? How much do you think t-shirts?
You're buying t-shirts.
Yeah, I'm not going to buy everyone cleats and.
I thought you were kidding out the team.
No, I meant I'd give
pinstripes and gray, you know, visitors away.
Pillar baseball shirts from this website, from the T Public thing. Like, I'll do Pillar t-shirts.
Oh, T Public, which is where you can buy your Pillar gear. It's a little pricey. I wonder if a local t-shirt printer might be better.
All right, but that's what I meant, is like baseball shirts and maybe hats.
Can I have one?
Of course. You'll be like Mr. Ducksworth. Get you your own jersey.
Quack, quack. This week's episode of the Pillar Podcast is brought to you by Seton Home Study School. To find out if Seton is right for your family, check it out at setonhome.org. The Pillar Podcast is a production of Pillar Media and JD Production. Our executive producer is Kate Oliveira. Our managing editor is Michelle LaRosa. I'm your host, J.D. Flynn. Ed Condon's my partner. We'll be back next week.